This is Joe Lee speaking at the Terre Haute, Indiana Midwinter Conference in 1981.
A lot of times you're asked to introduce speakers and you say, I just met him this afternoon. But I've known our speaker for several years. I've been privileged to hear him on two or three other occasions, and I like him very much. I don't want to get up here. I only have 3 or 4 minutes to introduce him, and I certainly am not going to try to outwit our speaker for tonight, leaving him with an hour or so. I won't do that. However, he's quite witty. He is serious about his sobriety, and he's serious about Alcoholics Anonymous. You're going to laugh a little bit. He might even sing a little for you. But he might have a message for you tonight, too. And it's with a great deal of love and respect that I present to you at this time, Joel from Tyler, Texas. Joel.
What you say about being witty is only half true. My name's Joe, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Joe.
And I wonder if you could clarify that breakfast we're going to have in the morning again. I'm thrilled beyond words to be here. There's no question about that. To be sober and to be alive and to be anywhere at this late date is quite a surprise to me. I've been around AA a long time. You can tell by looking at me I've been somewhere for a long time, I'll tell you. And I'm thrilled to death to be here in this, looking at these people. You're the healthiest-looking bunch of sickies I've ever seen in my life. You really are. You forgot to make one announcement. After the meeting is over tonight, Hal Marley and I will do a soft shoe on the pool over there next. On top of the water. He's dressed in his usual form tonight, early gay. I don't know. I've got a few notes here in case you don't understand that. I'll reveal them from time to time. Just about the time I was beginning to enjoy senility, they found a cure for it. I'm really thrilled to death, and I want to thank the committee. It's hard to find anybody that will admit to inviting me anywhere. But I want to thank all of the committee for letting me be present at such an auspicious occasion as this. Because this is really not for us to be afflicted with an awesome illness that we have, and the odds against us being here tonight are absolutely awesome. And I suspect that if we were serious for a few moments, we'd reflect upon the fact that we're a very fortunate minority of society to even be present, sober or not. I'm saying, grateful for that. And I don't really know how to get started tonight and be grateful. I was going to make a beautiful talk on humility. But you were just 20 people short of my usual amount. And, I don't know. Alcoholism is a very strange illness. I don't know. It's become very fashionable. Everybody wants to get in on the act now. It's the only disease known to mankind where the newcomer apologizes for not having it longer. And if your body don't play out till you've tried everything, you may make it here, I'll tell you. Because I came as a last resort to Alcoholics Anonymous. I tried everything to get sober and seemed that nothing worked. I tried psychiatry, and finding out that psychiatry is the art of picking the pocket through the scalp. I used to be, I admired Freud. I read everything he had. Freud, what am I doing? It's spelled differently, isn't it? It's Freud, it's not Freud. What the hell am I talking about? But I admired him strenuously. I read everything that he ever wrote. Of course, he stole most of it out of Macbeth, but... But I did. I admired him very strenuously until I found out he didn't have any willpower. And he couldn't quit smoking. And I don't have no use for anybody that ain't got no willpower, so I dropped Freud. And I tried yoga, you know. I even tried that. And I was doing real well in yoga until I got to the part where you stand on your head, and all my pills fell out of my pocket. Tried religion. And that's one thing I'd love to clarify here. AA is absolutely not a religion. Be sure you understand that early. And don't get hung up in that AA waltz. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. We got 12 steps in this program. But I've found about those religious people, all of them want to take hostages, every damn one of them. And now come with me. Our dearly beloved and all that jazz. And I wish sometimes that AA were a religion. And then I could shout and promise my way into sobriety. And I wouldn't have to work them damn steps. So I gave up on religion. I gave up on everything, really. And tried psychology. And never had much luck with that. I just couldn't figure out why I was like I was. And this is an exercise that we all get involved into, is why we're like we are. We spend a lot of exercise doing that. Some of us drowned in a puddle of profundity or in our own rhetoric. Them psychiatrists, you know, they convince me of a lot of things. And I got to where I was nearly believing what they said when I got to AA. Why we drank. Why we drank. Oh, for God's sake, that's a terrible thing. I don't give a damn why I drank. By the time I got to AA, I was worried about not drinking. And I wasn't the least bit worried in some long-haired old member standing up delineating upon illness alcohol. It was no question to me whatsoever. In our first little part of our book in there, Dr. Stiltworth tells us so damn simply that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. God, that's too simple for us. I was a member of a minority group, a genius. And that was entirely too simple for me. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. You know, them goddamn psychiatrists just had me convinced that I drank because my mama put me on the pot backwards. And we get into a lot of exercises in AA that have absolutely nothing to do with our being sober. Somewhere over in the book, Bill gets rather sarcastic with this and talks about theory and practicality. And I would say to you that the theoretical side of Alcoholics Anonymous is a beautiful place to live. But unfortunately, it's not the sober place in AA. And I believe Bill even gets so sarcastic to tell us that we have to practice this as a way of life. That's the solution to it. I don't know, I can tell you a little about my drinking. I have permission from the committee. It's so seldom that you hear people talk about their drinking in AA anymore. They've all got these letter-perfect setups for getting sober. But if you'll know these people who all have a letter-perfect solution to getting sober and staying sober, they never try them on themselves. I like to kill 9 of my first babies in AA trying to get them to use my solution to trying to get that. One of them stayed drunk 15 years and never got sober till he left me. So I want to talk a little about my drinking. And then I hope, if I have any text to my sermon at all tonight, that we'll talk about the 12th step, revisited. It seems that we develop all of the exercises in this society and don't quite get to the 12th step. The others are so exotic and fascinating and soul-tearing that by the time we go through this rigor of going through these steps, we somehow lose our breath by the time we get to the 12th step of Alcoholics Anonymous. So maybe we'll close tonight talking about it for a little bit. I drank. Oh, I like this word. I was swept into drinking innocently enough. I took my first drink when I was 17 years old, I think somewhere along about like Bob did. We drank alike a whole lot. And incidentally, that was a whale of a thing he said here last night. He did a whale of a job. And this morning, that young lady that talked about Al-Anon, this was my first Al-Anon meeting that I ever went to. And if that's the way you treat them, is that what they do in Al-Anon? No wonder we were so goddamn scared. And then our dear friend from New York today. And this has been a great experience in here. And let me say something to you. There seems to be a misapprehension about people who stand behind this podium and talk. Please believe me, it's not a competitive event. I've got one story to tell, and I like to die at making it. And it ain't no better or no worse than anybody else's story. And I'm so damn glad to get here that I'm not going to compete with anybody. Because in Alcoholics Anonymous, the object of the game is not to be better than or quicker than. Because if they had, it would have shot me out of the saddle. When I came to AA, I was about as smart as a mentally retarded boy with a tight derby on. So competition in our society is completely out of place, I'll say that. One night, I went out innocently enough with six more boys, and they gave me a drink of a thing called homebrew down in East Texas. And homebrew down in East Texas, you wouldn't believe it, what it is. I'll tell you, it's something else. And I took a drink that night, and I remember that drink as vividly as though it were yesterday. I remember the exhilarating glow of it. I remember what went on in this fungus between my ears. And I said to myself, where has this delightful thing been all this time? Why haven't they told me about this before? I have no psychological or clinical description to tell you what happened to me that night. I'm not going to delineate upon any of the extraneous things that could have happened in this fungus here. But I remember experiencing a few moments, and this word occurs in the book Alcoholics Anonymous many times, I experienced a few moments of relief. It brought me away from the wall and let me be a part of society, which I had never been before. And the duration of this exhilaration was very short-lived. I was a double P man all time I drank, puke and pass out. But the very, very few short moments of this great euphoria gave me a target to shoot at for the next 19 and a half years. And I never hit it again. I worked on it, goddamn, you know. Hit the happy medium. We were always shooting at that damn thing up there. Years ago, I drank in a very intellectual group in a wine joint across from the state capitol in Sacramento. And there was a rather polyglot aggregation of winos there. And one of our girlfriends, platonic of course, was a fortune teller from across the street there on K Street in Sacramento. And she would come over and get a few sniffs of Gallo and then run back over if she had one of them. She had a beautiful ball there on a green table and made a fairly decent living for her and two or three of us. And this was, I had been up the street. In Sacramento, you go up the street towards the river, and it's lower and lower and lower. And I had been up the street this morning and had caged a pint of gin somewhere and had brought it back to our favorite nesting place and had it sitting on the bar behind me, or in front of me. And you know how conversation goes in a bar, kind of like it is in AA. Nobody's listening. Everybody's talking. And somehow in this, I was swept up into the effect of this company that I was in. And I looked up and my bottle was gone. And this old gal, besides being an expert fortune teller, was a very proficient shoplifter. She made a fine art out of that, and she wore a voluminous garment, you know, the black ones with the turban up here, and she could hide a jug anywhere down in here up there. One of the nicest shoplifters I've ever met. And she started running out the back door as I discovered the loss of my pint. And I chased her through traffic, and God's a wonder both of us hadn't got killed. And I caught her, I got held up a little bit, and I got there just a little bit late. And she already had the neck off of the pint of this bottle and was raising it up to here. And that was the only time in the history of my drinking that I ever struck a happy medium. We never quite make it. Oh, God. And this is the beginning, I suppose, of our little theory that works on the alcoholic. today it'll be different. Today it will be different. And I guess we're pretty stupid. We do the same thing every morning and expect a different result. We do. Today we do the same thing as we did yesterday, but today it's going to be different. And if it doesn't happen to be different today, it will be tomorrow. And on the tombstone of most of us, you should put these words. Here lies a man who was looking for an ideal situation. And that's the story of an alcoholic. Now, it wasn't obsessive, neither was it compulsive in the first. But I went back to it again. I did what we call use alcohol. Because after that first drink, I knew what was there for me. I knew what it would do for me. An alcoholic, alcohol was an answer. It was not a problem. It'd bring me away from there and let me be a part of the world. And Bob said it so very effortlessly last night, that man's greatest fear is that fear of being rejected. We all got to have acceptance. We didn't, it'd have no ego at all. So, with drinking, there came, the first thing that ever happened to me was, I guess I became sophisticated, and it just blossomed me out, I'll tell you. And I was living in a little town called Tyler down in East Texas, and if you ain't ever been to Tyler, you don't need to go. Nobody ever goes to Tyler intentionally, you know. Our population's made up of people who have been stranded there at one time or another. But I started moving. Out of all the places for a poor drunk to end up, I had to end up in Hollywood, California, you know, shoot for the top. And I didn't go with any great search for anything like that, but I was taken in by one of the more eminent designers of ladies' lingerie, believe this or not, and became an understudy to him. Now this, and I hate to use this word, this queer profession is where you cut these soft silk sleazy intimate things that the ladies wear. If any of you girls got a pinch, I've been gone from there a long time. And we have I think this is where alcoholism began to close in on me and change its color. It became a problem somewhere in here. We've got a step in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the second one where it infers that you might have a gopher in the garden. If you cut a bunch of brassieres with three of those places in them, you're nuts. You're something nuts. I told a psychiatrist about that, and he said it was just wishful thinking. You know that. I can also prove I'm a human being, you know. And needless to say, I cut myself out of that profession, out of the golden opportunity. I'd love to report to you, I've just retired from my fifth profession. All of them as a result of being an alcoholic, and I have to say honestly to you that all of those I was a fraud in when I first went. I was a walking fraud. And I was cut out of this great opportunity. It was a wonderful opportunity. I'll date myself. I put the first pair of slacks on a gal called Marlena Dietrich in 1938, starting a trend that I see is still here tonight, putting slacks on the gals. It was a beautiful opportunity. And they said that I was a man that would go very far. I got quite a name in that profession. I did. I attained some sort of recognition about that. I was working for this kind Jewish fellow, a very delightful man, but he was a non-alcoholic employer, which is adequately taken care of in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. That's a chapter most people don't read. And he, like all of my subsequent non-alcoholic employers, could not ever understand why we get up every morning and set out to destroy ourselves. There's somehow or other that non-alcoholics can't understand why we do like we do. It's just that. Some of the Al-Anons can't do that. I was at a seminar not too long ago, and a psychiatrist asked me, he said, "Mr. Leith, what's the difference between an alcoholic and a non-alcoholic?" And I pondered, that's a hell of a question. It took me 3-4 minutes, and I finally come up, and I said to him, "I believe alcoholics drink more than non-alcoholics do." Yeah. And then he was undaunted, whatever the hell that means. And he said to me, "Well, tell me, why is it that when non-alcoholics drink, they don't become alcoholics?" And I said, "That's easy. They haven't got any willpower." "You got to be gutsy to get where we are, I'll tell you." Anyway, this fine Jewish fellow, he's a rather whimsical man. And he came to me one morning, "Good morning, Joe. You're fired." Brevity was a thing with him, I'll tell you. And then he made a remark that I thought was terribly sarcastic. He said that there's always some good comes out of everything. He said, "The way you handle those scissors, if you'd have been a rabbi, you'd have destroyed our whole race." You know? Here comes the thing in the beginning of the progression of the alcoholic. The first bitter hurt, the first humiliation, the first bitterness, and it brings to the alcoholic the necessity to come up with an answer of why it is happening to him. And this is the evasive answer that he chases until one day, if he's fortunate enough to find this society. And he lays in bed at night on the pillow and says, why? He's got to have a because and a why. Why is this happening to me? And he comes up with 1,000 answers, none of them quite to his own satisfaction. He's just not satisfied with his own answers. And this is the beginning of the trip that we call alcoholism. The war was going on at that time. I went out to the shipyard and bought a plumber's license out the back door of a union hall. Literally bought it, and I went into the shipyard as a master plumber. Here's a man that had never picked up anything any heavier than a pair of scissors, and you know I was a master fraud. And those were the days, if you remember when you were, and this is a horrible thing to remember, you were frozen to your job. Do you remember those patriotic things they had in those days? You know what they're saying to me? "You can't quit," they're saying to me. And an alcoholic does not like quit or don't. He cannot stand it in any form. I was just recently up in the University of Illinois talking one morning in a building like this, and there was a sign hanging on the wall over there. And the sign read, "Don't take the dishes out of this hall." And I'd talk a little while, and then my head would just go right on. "I got a report to you. I got 2 of them damn dishes at home. They have absolutely no collectible value, but they told me, don't take them." An alcoholic cannot stand that. He just can't. He can't sleep peacefully with that. He cannot live with that. And they told me I was frozen to my job. They're saying to me, "You can't quit." I have a pink document that hangs in my den now. And it's signed by the United States Department of War Labor, and it prohibits me from working within 25 miles of the city of Los Angeles. Who can't quit? Now, we're becoming used to the hurt. The shell's getting thicker. You know, they ask your wife, how's old Joe doing? Oh, he's doing better. Means that his bladder's stretching a little further. He can hold it longer, and he don't fall as quick anymore. That's about the progress that the alcoholic can make. But we say to the dear Al-Anon, I know none of you have ever done this, honey, let's go somewhere else where we don't know anybody. What we're saying is where nobody knows us. And start over again. This is the history of the alcoholic. Try it again. And we moved. The only thing wrong, I suspect, was the theory of moving an alcoholic from place A to place B, as that when you get there, there he is. It's that simple. And a moving alcoholic does not change anything about him, his odor nor his attitude nor anything else. But we get into what we so euphemistically talk about as the geography of alcoholism. And we moved from Los Angeles to Sacramento. I hear a lot of competitive, back to competition talks up here behind this podium. And it seems that in some of our little close meetings, we tell the sad stories of everything that has befallen us. And it does, I suspect, become competitive. The last fellow's the guy that wins the pot. I can win that hands down. I can win it without any problem at all. When we moved from Los Angeles to Sacramento, I was run over by the welcome wagon. And I remember how embarrassed that lady was trying to give me tickets to the car wash with me laying with one leg under the front wheel of that damn thing. And we move again. Keep it moving. This has been the treatment for us, since time begun until the advent of Alcoholics Anonymous. This has been the treatment for the alcoholic. Keep him moving. No family likes to admit they got one of us. You don't hear around the bridge table now. If one of the girls says, what's that noise I hear out in the back room? Oh, that's my son. He's an alcoholic, you know. Get it. Keep him moving. That has been the history of what? Until somebody let us stop long enough to get our breath and try to figure out what made us tick. So, and it seems to me another little affectation of the alcoholic that as he goes along, the choices of things for him to do become less and less and less and less. And we take the next best thing and the next best thing. And we've got a good old reason why we do. Tomorrow it's going to be better, but today I'm going to do this. And I went to work, of all places, for the railroad. And I'd love to report to you here there. A group of the most narrow-minded people I believe I've ever met. They've got a rule about drinking. And it reads that if you're seen coming out of an establishment that dispenses alcoholic beverages, you can be fired. I was not seen coming out very often. And if I was then, I was an unidentified flying object, you know. I get a kick out of some of the youngsters that come to AA now. They have to identify. And they come in, you know, about half drunk. I can't identify. Well, this seems to be a product of the 60s, of the youngsters that come in. Let me tell you something. If you identify and you don't find a solution to your problem, you can die identified. That ain't the name of the game. But just in case it is, years ago in General Service, they had a pamphlet. I think they still have it. It's a rather innocuous piece of work called 44 Questions. And they were my little old questions like, did your wife give you that look today? Or did you gargle with too much Livoris? I got some questions here that I devised out of my sheer genius that I think it'll take less than 44 for us to identify with one another. Have you ever had the roof of your mouth sunburned? Have you ever had malfunction of the zipper? They used to call me Rusty. Have you ever been arrested while in jail? Have you ever been run over by your own car while driving it? You know? Have you ever woke up with a circus midget in bed with you? Did you hear about that midget that got thrown out of the nudist colony because he was going around getting his nose in everybody's business? Okay, Pat. Have your Al-Anon ever thrown an electric cord in the bathtub with you? My God, I think we're getting to where we can identify here tonight, you know. We can really identify tonight. I'll give you the last question, and this seems to be the one that separates the men from the boys, or you don't say that in Hollywood, they do it with a broomstick out there. Ah, yes, the natives are restless tonight, aren't they? For God's sake. Have you ever woke up in the morning feeling rather delicately and lose your glasses and wash your teeth with Preparation H? I don't think we got to go too much further. I think that there's some of you cats out there that evidently can identify. So if that's the only problem, we've taken care of that. Now you need to admit you got a problem and do something about it. We're at that point, as Bill used to say in Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to work for the railroad, and as I said, they had that rule about drinking, and I felt that they were rather narrow-minded in their assumption of that. And I'm sure they knew what they were doing. They felt that if a man was a little bit addled, he'd, you know, cause him some trouble. He used to run more than one train on a track. And I'm going to have to be honest with you, I never did quite figure out how they did it. One of the great complaints we hear in Alcoholics Anonymous, and this is by the poor old drunk who couldn't hide his jug from that snooping Al-Anon. This is used to be a common plea. You don't hear it maybe so much now since they've invented square bottles. One night on the railroad, I was called on. Maybe you can follow this vernacular, this parlance of the railroad. I was called off of the extra board as a conductor. And people on the, anybody that's on the extra board voluntarily on a railroad means one thing, that you're not a desirable member to be on a regular crew. I can straighten that out for you right now. So the floaters and the people like me who were rather erratic in their habits were all on the extra board. And I got called one night as a conductor to go on a fruit train from Roseville, California to Marysville, where there was some English peas or something getting ripe up there. I never did find out what it was. And I had to help the engineer up on the engine so we could leave town. It's a good thing you don't have to guide a train. It really is an awfully good thing you don't have to guide one. We got the fireman out of jail to go and help the engineer on there. And I had been drinking a little. Needless to say, we made it up there because you don't have to guide. And we got up there and did a little work through brute force and awkwardness. I fell over a few switches, but not bad. We were just getting right along. And about 10 o'clock in the evening, I discovered a big, long packing shed like you see out by railroad tracks. And this packing shed had a track running in it, quite a good piece. And it occurred to me that we had worked long enough. So I took my train and started chopping it up in little pieces. I leave a car here, two cars there, three cars there, all over the city of Marysville to where it had no resemblance of a train. And then I took the engine and the caboose and put them in this shed, and we killed the fire and locked the door. And you can't guess where we went. And war was going on at that time, and the dispatcher, shall we say, was rather concerned. Trains were going every which way. It was just a big mess all the way around, but he had absolutely lost extra 495. And you're supposed to run over these little beepers on the track. They give him code in his ear, and he ain't heard no code. And nobody has reported us as passing by. And he really did. He became concerned about it, and terribly so. And he called all up and down the railroad, I learned later. And finally he sent an official in an automobile up there to look for us where we had been last seen. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, he came into this combination bar and pool hall, and he was real upset, to say the least. And these are the questions that he asked me first. What did you do with it? And we couldn't hide a jug from that broad, you know, but we can hide a whole train load of cars. I don't know, this is where I suddenly took the landslide. This is where you go over the top and down the hill. And quite innocently enough, I had gotten on wine by this time, and I don't know, there's something different about wine, is there not, Larry? Yeah, there is something quite different about it. People make fun of the winos, and he is a very strange person, but they make fun of wine. Wine is it's a fine thing. It has some great medicinal purposes. If you drink it, it'll cure hay fever. You never see an old wino walking around, it's got hay fever. If you drink it like I did, you ain't going to sneeze. And I said, yeah, for sure. Ooh. It'll clear up hay fever in a hurry, I'll tell you. But it's got a bad reputation. Terribly bad reputation. I had stumbled over these fellows going from my hotel to the depot and see them laying, and in those days it was a pathetic sight. Sacramento had the reputation for being the worst skid row in the world when I came to AA. And this was probably the only feeling that I had for these fellows. They don't have the price of another drink because my life blood hinged upon the price of another drink. This was all I needed. And I kept going down and down and down. And we hurt everything that we touch, it seemed. Seems to me that the alcoholic who sits on the bar stool and boasts that it's my money and my business and I'm not hurting anybody but myself is the absolutely outblown ego of a crazy man. Seems to me that everything I touched suddenly started to decay at this point. Everything that I started to touch. And nobody can understand us. Nobody can understand us. The non-alcoholic people, I suspect, the wives in their terror, cannot understand why we repetitively set out to do things that destroy us. And you know why we can't give them an answer? Because we don't have one. We just don't have one. You know, they ask you a lot of silly questions. You know, you can... I don't know. I was driving an erratic automobile one time, and by some strange quirk, I ran into a tree. Bad steering column or something. And they didn't... You know, I know that game. I've played it a lot of times. You wait for the police to get there. Nobody had put any chairs there for me to sit in. And so I climbed up in the tree. And when the policeman got there, do you know what he asked me? What are you doing up in that tree? There's no answer to that question. They ask you questions, you know. You go out to get a loaf of bread, and you come back a few weeks later. That old broad, where have you been? Nowhere. She ain't gonna give up. What have you been doing? Nothing. Everybody knows that you can't be nowhere doing nothing. And then that provokes in them their highest point of brilliance. They ask you, have you been drinking? Two beers. And this is the clash of understanding that nobody seems to surmount until some dummy comes along and asks one of us a question that we're tuned in on. And it seems to me that that guy's got to be one of us. There's a great philosopher one time said that it is a greater feat to jog the understanding than to jog the memory. And this seems to be the case with the alcoholic. Nobody can jog the understanding. So I went down, down, down. I ended up in the hospital in San Francisco, and this is before the days when we had all of the... Put my clock upside down. I could have talked all night here, you know. They didn't have the great knowledge, so-called, of alcoholism as it did today, and they put me in a railroad hospital in the nervous ward, where I honestly belong. And I shook out one of the most terrible things on earth. And in the hospital, I became acquainted with another delightful little dose that I had never had before. And that was a thing that you don't hear much about now. And it was sodium bromide elixir. This is the granddaddy of Nervine. You ever hear Aunt Minnie drinking Nervine? You remember Nervine. Surely you do up here. They used to say, Aunt Minnie can't come out today. She's nervous. Aunt Minnie was stoned. And they give me this. I was drinking a combination of Gallo wine. We had a Mexican go down and get it, bring it up the elevator. And drinking sodium bromide elixir, which is a hellish dose. It destroys the memory and makes your eyes cross and you froth at the mouth a little, but other than that, there's not many side effects. And this beautiful, beautiful thing about sodium bromide elixir, food doesn't disturb it. You can eat right along. Man, you're in the business there then. And then they put on top of this aggregation of fine stuff, a dose that they had invented then. This was before the beautiful days of Valium. They gave me phenobarbital. This was before they could pop you in the butt with enough Thorazine to keep you from bouncing against the wall. You know that. So I'm drinking sodium bromide elixir, Gallo wine, popping a few phenobarbital, and letting them all run concurrently. And you can imagine my, shall we say, state of mind. And my recovery didn't take place. But I had kind of set up shop in that hospital for the winter, as was my wont. And one day a psychiatrist came to me and said, you got to go. You got to get out of here and let some sick people come in this hospital. And they put me on the street. And that was the beginning of the end for me. All the time during my drinking, I'd always had one thing, and I know none of you guys ever done this. I used to go home to Mama when I got in trouble. I had a delightful childhood. It lasted 37 years. And I didn't have any place to go over to go home to Mama. I hated Texas with a passion. I hated everybody there. I didn't want it. And I walked back to Texas. Now, here's the smart guy, the resourceful fellow with all the answers. The cat from Hollywood and Beverly Hills. The Sharpie. The arrogant one. Walking home to Mama. You know, a lot of times we have to do things that we have to do. And this was the exact reversal of the story of the prodigal son. They saw him coming from afar and threw his butt in jail. They didn't kill no fatted calf. And I remember this. If I never remember another thing, I remember the seething hatred. The pitiful, helpless bitterness of an alcoholic. In the throes of an illness that he doesn't even know that he has. And he strikes out like a snake at anything close. And I suspect that if anything bad ever happens to me in this society, ultimately, even after the time I have been here, it will be because I have forgotten my helplessness. how absolutely helpless we are. We talk in Alcoholics Anonymous about resentments, and we try to pinpoint them. And I suspect that the alcoholic in this condition, in the last condition, that his big resentment is against his own helplessness. He resents his own helplessness, and possibly he resents even being alive. He's in a state where you don't pinpoint resentments anymore. And he doesn't have any why, and he doesn't have any because. And he suffers the humiliation that there is no answer for. That's the reason Bill tells us in our book, you see, he was a great flair for words, and he talked about illusions and difficulties and concerns and finally about a problem, but he said problem's not enough. We had a dilemma. And a dilemma is a problem that offers no answer. If you look for it in a dictionary, die in Latin means two, and you get two answers, both of them which are unpleasant, is what you got when you got a dilemma. And this is the dilemma of alcoholism to me. And now maybe there will not be as much humor as there has been. I'm in here in this condition that I have tried to describe to you as best I can. And one Monday morning there came a fellow to my cell whom I had never seen before. And he came to talk to me. And I remember how I resented him. He was a dullard, a dum-dum, talking to this smart fellow like me. And he stood there as peaceful as you could imagine and told me about this program of ours, all in the first person. He talked about himself. He would not let me talk. I had all the answers, and I suspect he knew it. And he sounded like a Victrola record. We have found from our experience, you know. We have found from our experience. And I would submit to you, as you go along in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a lot of difference between sharing your experience and imposing your opinion on someone. I just thought I'd throw that in. And I couldn't ruffle him. And I suspect that maybe I'm standing here tonight because I couldn't make that man react. Everybody I'd ever dealt with prior to this time, I'd cut them and knife them and make them react. He wouldn't do it. That bastard stood still. Just as still as you please, and I couldn't make him move. Oh, we have found from our experience. And I wouldn't take it. I was too far in the shell. But there was something happened there that night. And if you reflect upon the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about in there what we were like, what happened. And the dictionary says that that's an act of providence. A happening is. Something happened there that night, and I suspect that I unconsciously aroused in me a few questions of why he came. Let me tell you, maybe, why he came, if I can read our book, Alcoholics Anonymous. There seems to be a great misapprehension about why we go to see alcoholics. We don't go to see alcoholics because they're alcoholics. We go to see alcoholics because we're alcoholics. That was taken care of in the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel in the year 1934, and Bill walked away from that bar trembling, and he said these words, "Suddenly I discovered that I needed him more than he needed me." So this guy came to that jail not to see Jolie. He came to perpetuate his own sobriety. And I happen to be the lucky one standing there, and for that I'm so terribly grateful. I just happened to be the guy he was working on. We'll go to the first paragraph of chapter 7 in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and I shall read it to you. and it's very brief. Practical experience shows us that nothing so much ensures our sobriety as intensive work with other alcoholics. Nothing so much ensures our sobriety as intensive work with other alcoholics. And then he makes a promise that this works when all other activities fail. This works. I want a sure way. By God, I want the odds working for me. Nothing so much ensures our sobriety. Then he says, this works when all other activities fail. When your prayer group blows it, when your transcendental meditation group blows it, when your sitting and touching group blows the hell out of it, this works when all other activities fail. And this guy had read this, and he had studied his lessons well, because our two co-founders proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that this program would work by working it. This is how they proved that it would work, by working it. And then they gave us the greatest gift that I suppose any society has ever had as a gift. They wrote it down. And this is our great gift. I heard Bill say this out of his own mouth, that we had to have a book so that the message of Alcoholics Anonymous would not become garbled. He used that word as a favorite Yankee word, G-A-R-B-L-E-D. Garble means mix up and screw up and everything else. And he well knew the fallacy of mankind. He also knew the fallacy of alcoholics. And he knew that it was impossible for me to tell him something and let him tell the next one, and that one tell the next one, and by the time it gets to the end of this row, it has no resemblance of where it started. An alcoholic cannot repeat a story. He's got to get it dressed up. And Bill well knew that, and he said we had to have a message, we had to have the book, we had to have it written down so that this message would not become garbled, that it would be the same then as it is today. And for that I'm so terribly grateful. There are those newcomers who say that maybe the book is old-fashioned, I don't know. Whenever the disease changes, we'll change the treatment. This is the reason that I stand here today, through no great effort of my own, was the fact that that fellow had read his lessons well, and he had studied. And in the last word that follows, this works when nothing else fails, the probably one of the shortest sentences in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and it is followed by an exclamation mark. What usually is preceding an exclamation mark? I'm somewhat of an English scholar. Either a command or a direct request. And this is the simple sentence that follows what we just read. Carry this message to the other alcoholics! Exclamation mark. And then we sit around AA in our brilliance and genius and intellectuality and want to interpret the big book. How are you going to screw up a sentence that simple? And I suspect that this is the prerequisite. And I'm going to say to you, sarcastically, if you don't lie, most of the things that have helped me in AA have first made me mad. And there ain't a damn thing in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous about hurting somebody's feelings. Or at least I ain't been able to find it. Millie, have you? But if you don't know what it is to sit on the foot of the bed and share this shameful experience that you had, whether you helped anybody or not, you have not enjoyed the fruits of our program. And it is impossible for you to work the whole program without doing it. I don't know, I guess I could talk for a long time about Chapter 7 in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and never enough, because I stand here because he had read his lesson well and came and stood in front of that jail cell and made it possible for me to live again. And I'm sure that if you were to ask him when he left that day, did he do any good? No. Smart ass. The worst one. Real smart guy. I'm sure that he felt pretty bad about making that call. And I went back to California. My people were good citizens down there in Texas, and they hired two deputy sheriffs to load me into a police car and carry me 200 miles to Houston, Texas, and put me on a train headed west. This is what we euphemistically talk about in Al-Anon as releasing him with love. And I got off of that train in a wheelchair, and they carried me off. I'd set up shop in one of the toilets, and some smart ass said, "You got to get off. We're going to use this car. It goes both ways. You can't live in it." And when I got up to walk, I couldn't, which was, in those days, was nothing new. And they carried me off in a wheelchair and dumped me in front of the old station in Los Angeles. And with all of the jocular remarks that we might make about the ridiculous antics of an alcoholic, and the fun we may have in looking back upon it, I can honestly say to you that in the next 5 months I drank as few people have and lived to tell the tale. And finally the light went out. I ended up in a flop house in Sacramento, and seems to me that every time I opened up one of my old bags, that this fellow had given me a pamphlet as he walked away from me in jail. A pamphlet that had been written by two losers. We didn't have the dearth of literature that we have now in Alcoholics Anonymous, for which I'm so grateful. On the front of this pamphlet read, "Slaves of Drink, Find Peace of Mind." It had been written by a doctor who died drunk and a pillhead who I saw the other day flapping around on his ankles. Two losers made this contribution to my sobriety. And in the study of the history of this society, I've had to go and be honest with myself that if you can't learn to love the losers, you ain't going to have no winners in this outfit. I can honestly say that. Some of the probably 60% of the contributions that were made to the perpetuation of this society of ours were made by people who did not get to enjoy 1 minute of sobriety. Think about that for a while. This pamphlet had been written by them. The front of it read, "Slaves of Drink, Find Peace of Mind." And seemed to me, in the maudlin state that I was in, every time I opened a bag there, that damn thing was on top. I didn't read it. Didn't have the guts to. But I'll also say to you that from the day I left that jail until the day I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I could not erase that man from in front of me. I could not get him out from in front of me. And there's some lines in our book, the 12 and 12, in the study of the first step, wherein it says that it is impossible for us to go and present ourselves to another person that it shall ever be forgotten. It is a lasting thing when you share of yourself with a stranger. I couldn't get him out from in front of me, and I couldn't go to sleep to get him out from in front of me, and the more I thought about it, the more he bothered me. And one night, I got all of me I could stand. So, I'd already taken care of you, but that night I got all of me that I could stand, and I did, I guess, what it takes to punch the ticket into Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, God help me. That and nothing more. And I got up and walked out of that flop house. And we'll talk about willpower. Those of you who can even imagine the condition I was in, to get up and walk out of there for a few steps and sit down and rest. And I walked 2,600 miles back to the fellow that gave me that pamphlet. That's really a story of pathos, isn't it? Really a dramatic story. How would you like to find out that when I'd been in AA for 3 months, I discovered that there was an AA club 3 blocks from that goddamn flop house in Sacramento? That'll tear your story up, I'll tell you. But I had to do it, and I had to do it my way, and I think that my way is the only way for me, and your day is your day. I just hope you get one. And I went back to take that fellow, and he took me to my first AA meeting, and his message hadn't changed, maybe mine had a little bit. And I got to tell you about that first AA meeting. I got well in a hurry. I was a quick recovery. And he took me to my first AA meeting. It was upstairs. I don't know. Years ago, they all used to be upstairs. And they shoved me up the stairs. I was sort of suffering from malnutrition, weakness, and whatnot. And I have to compare every other AA meeting with that one that night. I do not remember any of the profundities that the old AA member said that night, any of the so-called jewels of wisdom that were dropped. I remember experiencing a communication in this AA meeting like which there is none other. I discovered that night, here are some people like me. And the terrible loneliness when I discovered that I was not an only one. And I think every alcoholic lives with the theory that he's an only one. We're the only one that has had this bad deal. And that night that loneliness left me. And by the process and the facility of Alcoholics Anonymous, it has not returned, thank God. That loneliness. And that night I became we and forgot about I that night. And here's some people on every side of me. I remember what little the fellow that wrote the Members Eye View. He was a very dear friend of mine. And he made the statement that I was thrust into a group of people completely devoid of personalities. And that was my experience in coming to AA. Nobody looked at me as though it seemed, and it seemed to me that they stopped everything that they were doing and became enamored of me. And this was my great luck in AA. And I hope that our responsibility, if we have one, will be that we give that guy a break the first night he comes. You don't know how long he's been coming. You don't know what circumstances and what circuitous route he has followed to get there. But whatever he sees that night, when he walks away, that will be Alcoholics Anonymous. And it will be your responsibility to show him either the good or the bad. And I suspect that I was made or broken that night in AA. There came from the back of the group an old feller that had on 2 pistols. He was the sheriff who had locked me up for drunk driving, felonious drunk driving, I might say, prior to that time many years. And here he stood in AA that night with those pistols on. A very symbol of everything that I hated. He was a man who was known for brutality, had a reputation for bouncing prisoners off of the wall. And he came up that night from the back of the room and put his arm around me. And I suspect that he gave me the essence of what we get in this society of ours. He said, "I love you, boy. You can stay sober like I do." What is this crude and irregular transmittal that we have? Is it not jogging the understanding? Is it not the greatest movement towards understanding at all? And somehow or other, I could not see any personality in that man anymore. This is the gift of our society. Unobstructed love and acceptance. Then over set to one side there, a guy when he was... I was still not... Oh, I was in a sort of a semi-stratospheric state of lucidity. My eyes would cross at intervals, and I hadn't completely recovered enough to be genius yet. And there sat a fellow over to the side there, gently puffing on a cigar, and he had on a big diamond ring, and he had one of these serenity things that some of us get. And he worried me the whole meeting. Worried me the whole time, and I wondered, I thought, "God, I know that man. I know that man from somewhere." He's sitting there puffing on a cigar, just as peaceful as anything you ever saw. After the meeting, I discovered that I had soldiered with him 20 years prior to that time, and that the last time I had seen him, he was chained to a post in an army camp. This was the army's treatment for alcoholism. And we would slip him whiskey just to watch him perform on this chain like a monkey. He was a real comedian. And here he sits this night in an AA club, puffing on the cigar, big thing here, diamond ring. You know what my first reaction was? If it'll help him that much, it'll make a damn genius out of me. I don't know. How are you going to measure one breath after another? We can't do it. I cannot compare AA with anything. There's no way to compare one's life. The gift of being able to stand here or stand anywhere at this particular time. I'll tell you of two little instances that I had that were great in my growth in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got 7 more minutes in case you need to go to the toilet. I had the quickest recovery known to mankind. In 2 weeks in AA, I was quit cussing. And I just knew it all by rote. You know, I could answer any goddamn question you asked me. You might even say I became godlike. And I got a call one night to go see a drunk in a bar. And all he wanted was for me to retrieve his bottle and get him to where he wanted to go. But I couldn't see that. I was too godlike. And I retrieved his bottle and put him in the car behind me, between me and another alcoholic, and I started to give him the pitch. And God, I felt good. And as I talked with sheer eloquence and a little piosity, his eyes began to water. And I thought, I'm getting him. And as we drove slowly on and I talked with further eloquence and piosity, he gently lay his head over on my shoulder, and I knew I had him. Did you ever hear of a drunk puking silently? Yeah. Every time I've ever gotten godlike with one of them, they throw up on me for some reason. I don't know. I don't know how long you work with a guy. I worked with one when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous for 4.5 years. My wife took the call one Sunday morning, and he was a dingbat like me, you know, a little scurvy and bordering on DTs. And I borrowed a goblet of whiskey from one of my friends and poured it down him to, you know, Dr. Joe. And he knocked him out, really. And when he kind of came unshackled from that drink, he was in an AA group. I believe any way you get him there is good. And he got sober under my guidance. Oh, God, I love that. And he stayed sober for 3 months, and then he got drunk. And it didn't hurt him. He was used to it. But it sure raised hell with my ego, and I went back and got him again. You're going to have to sober up, like I say. And that's a bad thing, like I say. And he stayed sober for another 3 months and got drunk again. He had a little affectation. I know none of you folks have got. He'd go to faraway places and call me collect just to tell me that he was drunk. And I'd pray about him, you know. I'd learned how to pray then. And I'd say, God, you've been watching the sparrows too much, so let me have this one, you know. He's a real dingbat. But I went back and got him again. And I did that for 4.5 years, intermittently. Never stayed sober over 3 months at any one given time. 12 years ago, he got drunk in one of our local motels. And he called another feller from our group who's not half as smart as I am. And he went out and talked to that bastard 10 minutes, and he's never had another drink to this day. And I hated his guts. I used to sit in the club and look at him and say, you ought to be mine. And if I know anything of the treasure that God gives us in Alcoholics Anonymous, that dirty bastard kept me sober for 4.5 years. I owe him more than he could ever pay me. I don't know. Following the path. The only statistic that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we'll go home, is the word rarely. It says in the beginning of chapter 5, rarely. That's the only statistic that we've got. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has followed our path. What is our path? Well, our path is the 12 steps. Our path is the 12 traditions. Our path is making coffee. That's our path. And I suspect that the greatest ability that we get in the path is in the search. And our path is the ability to say, I love you, which was foreign to us. Wonder if we could run a little quick dialogue on the path and see it as maybe some of us do, or maybe as some of us don't. In my mental gymnastics, I could see the path, and a long and dreary one. On this path there are 12 gates, so situated in time and space that you cannot open one without opening the next. And if I remember, the first gate was the most treacherous one to open. It seemed to have something to do with an admittance, which the alcoholic can't do. It was a rather ragged-looking gate. It had been beaten and kicked and shaken. It was very sturdy and hard to open. But once opened, it let you go to the second gate. The second gate was something like coming to believe this gate. It had a bad hinge and a rusty latch, but by practice could be opened. And the third gate was even more treacherous, becoming willing to turn it over. These three gates opened the way to the other gates, and each subsequent gate seemed to be easier to open. And as we raced down it, we thought that we had the whole thing made, until we got to the last gate, and here lay a fellow propped up against the latch. We said to him, "What are you doing there?" And he said, "Well, I really don't know. I saw you coming and tried to get out of your way. By the way, how did you get on this path?" "Oh, I can't remember. Some fellow came to a jail cell many years ago and told me about it." "Do you think I could get on that path?" "Well, it seems to me that you stand between me and opening the last gate." We picked him up, and he was not the least bit offensive, nor was he heavy, and turned to go back to the first gate. And as we looked over our shoulder, the last gate was opened. And it suddenly dawned on us that this was the beginning and not the end. Thank you so very much.